Okay, I think we are all here. Counsel, I heard both of you speaking and the sound sounded good. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You're our third oral argument this morning on a calendar of six cases to be heard by Judges Hooten, Frisch, and me, Tracy Smith. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. At the start of your principal arguments, if you could each introduce yourself and the party you represent for the record, that would be great. And then when we're not speaking, we each try and remember to mute ourselves just to cut down on noise. Okay, so this case is A20-0211, Kevin James Stanton versus appellant versus Megan Caroline Curran, respondent. Counsel for appellant, when you are ready to go, just state your name again and a party you represent for the record. You'll have 15 minutes.
I just need a minute. All right. Good morning. May I please the court? This is Nahid Abul Hassan on behalf of the appellant, Kevin James Stanton. The appellant appealed this case after a lengthy trial. We had a two-week trial. And before that, there were several motions filed. Unfortunately, this was a very short-lived marriage. The parties have a child who was born before the marriage. There was a divorce filed, and then was put in an inactive status, and the parties reconciled, and then that case was dismissed for not being activated within 6 months. Then the parties did it again. I listed 9 issues for the court to review. First of all, when the petitioner or the appellant filed this case, the child was less than 2 years old. And he requested that the child's name, last name, to be changed to his name. Within 6 weeks from filing for divorce, the respondent changed her last name, which was the appellant's last name, to her own last name. And after that, she moved to object to changing the child's last name. The law is clear. He is a biological father. The court made finding. The statute and case law are clear. All the facts.
Can I ask you, do you agree that the standard proof for your client was clear and compelling evidence that
yes,
the substantial welfare of the child necessitated a name change?
And I addressed that in my brief. I went through all the factors for the court to consider, and none of them would support not changing the child's last name. The child is young.
Well, why is the court's finding that you failed, that there was a failure to commit clear and compelling evidence?
The court relied on Hansen's Robinson case. That case is not applicable to this case. That case was the other way around. When a mother wanted to change the children's biological last name, father's biological last name, to her new husband's name, and the court asked her to have a compelling and convincing evidence. Here, we don't have that issue. He is a biological father. So the court relied on the wrong case. And also, in the application of Saxton, the court clearly set the boundaries or the criteria for checking the factors which will support the best interest of the child. The child is young. He doesn't have a preference now. The length of the time this child carried this name is he's 4, 5. He doesn't have any association with any community that might bring him embarrassment if the name is changed. The effect of the changing the child's name. Actually, what's happening now is confusing. The child knew mother carried his father's last name. Now mother changed the last name and refuses to change the child's last name. So the effect of not changing the child's last name is actually negative. Father would like to have his son carry his last name. And the court did not go through the four or five factors to analyze whether or not changing the name would be in the best interest of the child. The other issue is parenting time. The court set this child to have parenting time with his dad in high supervision until the child is 8. First of all, there is no order for protection against between the father and the child. There is none. Mother at the beginning filed for an order for protection to include the child. The court dismissed that part of the order for protection, and the court clearly made finding that the child, the father did not harm the child by any means. There was a maltreatment charge attached to that case, and the father successfully overturned that maltreatment.
You know, and I did go over the report I think Janet Talent, who did the custody evaluation, and the psychological report of Dr. Harrington. And one thing that is mentioned on numerous occasions is that the child was present at the time there was domestic violence between the two parents. And with that, the fact that the child was present, and in fact, sometimes the child would be screaming and crying and distress. Wouldn't that be sufficient for the court to, based on that evidence by these experts, by these mutually agreed upon experts, to limit or restrict parenting time? So the child wouldn't be a party to the domestic violence.
Well, being present when domestic abuse happens is not ground to issue an order for protection against the children too. These allegations were negated by the case challenging the maltreatment. The experts wrote this report before the maltreatment charge was overturned. And when the expert came to court, we questioned about if that would change the recommendation if they knew that the maltreatment charge was overturned. And the only answer we got from Carol Tillett is that she made this recommendation to have a child in a high supervision setting, and it's unique, she has never done it, but she did it in order to prevent the child to be exposed to traumatic events. When we asked her about what she meant, she referred to an incident happened in Byerly's. A day before that, the person who witnessed that incident, an argument between two adults, happened in 2016. The same person who was involved in that argument testified and said, that argument was by no means near the child. So she's relying on information that is inaccurate. The rest of the information is based on hearsay. As I noted in my brief, that the court accepted into evidence all of respondents' exhibits, and they were all based on hearsay, including the evidence to try to support her claim that the house where she's residing now is marital home. My client's father gave his four children $2 million as inheritance upon his death. He gave him a condo during his life and amended his trust to state that the condo value is an advanced inheritance and deducted that amount. They did an appraisal specifically for that reason.
Well, and I know that there was conflicting evidence submitted to the court, and apparently or at least your client was claiming that it was non-marital property. But the court considered other evidence and found otherwise. I mean, are you asking us to retry the case and weigh the evidence and reweigh the evidence and come up with a different result?
Yes, because the other evidence was considered or explained by the person who prepares the tax every year for my client's father. And he clearly stated it was his habit or practice in his business to benefit from a maximum amount of tax gift exclusion. And he did this over the years. And for
But is that our role as a reviewing court to reweigh the evidence and come up with a different result?
Well, we need the court to at least to remand this case to the court to look at other evidence that the court excluded for no ground, and to look at evidence that the court included, which were in violation of the rule of evidence. So this whole ruling is based on hearsay, including restricting my client's parenting time. With regard to attorney's fees, this is the part where it's shocking to me. At the time the court issued this order, ordering my client to pay need-based attorney's fees, he was out, he was unemployed. He started a business that wasn't generating money yet. He was paying child support based on income imputed on him. The court very much rubber stamped the proposed order given by opposing counsel, which is the case in all of the court orders in this proceeding, including the typos. The court didn't even bother to fix some typos it contained in the proposed order of opposing counsel. The case law is clear. If you think my client did something wrong, has a bad faith conduct, tell me what he did. You can't just submit a proposed order saying, I want $200,000 attorney's fees, $100 for need-based, and $100 for conduct-based. We don't have any. Even the reason listed in the proposed order does not. None of them support an attorney's fees. Tell me what conduct my client involved in and how much it cost you. When it comes to need-based, there was a dual signature account that my client challenged from day one. It was the proceed from selling his condos and non-marital condos. That court awarded every dime in that account to the respondent. That account should have not been touched because it was challenged as a non-marital claim. The only reasonable thing the court could have done is to maintain the house using that bank account to pay for taxes, insurance, etc. But it gave the respondent everything she asked for. It gave her attorney's fees. It gave her $10,000 for the tax, garnishing $10,000 from the account for my client, which is his money. The court seems to make her its mind from the beginning that this account should not be considered non-marital. Many of the requests for attorney's fees, for example, I give one example. Respondent asked for a reimbursement of $20,000 she paid for supervised parenting time. That amount was paid or equally shared per stipulation. Stipulation is an agreement. Both parties were represented by counsel when they signed that stipulation. The court did not even explain why the $20,000 that was paid based on the party's stipulation should be reversed, why the stipulation should be put aside. The reason for invalidating a contract are not present here. Also, when you add the three affidavits for attorney's fees, the amounts don't match. Why? Because counsel never submitted any invoice showing how she came up with this amount. The only thing we get from council is in March, I spend this much. In April, I spend that much. There are no details. There is a big violation of the Minnesota General Rule of Practice, Rule 119, when it comes to attorney's fees. Council had the audacity when my client's formal counsel asked for invoices to draft a proposed order and give it to the judge, and the judge, the referee signed it that opposing counsel is not entitled to review invoices. Why? What is counsel hiding? Also, there is no ground to support a need-based. First, the respondent lived in a mortgage-free home. All the expenses associated with that home were paid from my client's account. He claimed that it was non-marital. First attorney's fees, and the amount of, I believe, was $25,000. Both parties asked the court for permission to use the dual signature account to pay for their attorney's fees. The court denied my client's request and granted mother's request. Mother was granted to take money for her own attorney's fees from that account, which my client claimed to be non-marital, but he was denied. Many of the reason for attorney's fees don't make sense. For example, the court said, I cross-examined the custody evaluator for too long.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you, your time is up. If you can take a moment and wrap up, you'll have time for rebuttal as well.
Yes, we're asking the court to review this injustice, the evidence. I understand the file is huge, but there is huge injustice here to target my client's inheritance, to come up with reasons that are not supported with the evidence presented. Does not support the court finding and conclusion to not change the child's name, to not allow my clients to have unsupervised parenting time, to not consider the evidence that my client offered to support his claim for non-marital, and to review the attorney's fees award because it's a miscarriage of justice. There are no rules followed here. There are no explanation for this huge amount of attorney's fees. And at the same time, the person who added to the cost of this is a respondent. The filing of the respondent is unbelievable in this case. It seems. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, if you could state your name and a party you represent, and go ahead.
Thank you so much. My name is Becky Rooney, and I am counsel for Megan Curran, the respondent both in these proceedings and at the trial court level. Before I address any of the specific of the 9 issues raised by the appellant in his brief, I'd like to talk for a bit about the considerations that we believe that this panel needs to bring to its analysis of the judgment and decree in light of the manner in which this appeal has proceeded. First of all, on the easy matter, that's the standard of review to be employed by this court. We have identified the applicable standard in our portion of the brief that addresses each of the specific issues that are raised. They are somewhat nuanced. It isn't simple as determining whether or not the findings are supported by the evidence or whether there was an inappropriate application of the law. We ask the court to reference, in terms of standard of living, any nuances that are addressed or a consequence of the nature of the issue being looked at. But aside from the issue of standard of review, which we always talk about when we're dealing with an appeal, there are some other considerations we think are important for this court to keep in mind as it conducts its review. And the first most basic one is, in truth, we believe a fair reading of the appellant's brief suggests that this court is not faced with any real dispute. First of all, that the trial court either misunderstood or misapplied the law. There really isn't anything specific that's been urged in that regard. Or secondly, that any of the court's very detailed and nuanced findings are not, in fact, supported by the record here. In truth, what we're really dealing with is a grievance list brought by the appellant with the hope of a do-over. And it's a list of of disagreements with decisions made by the trial court that are not only supported by the record, but are supported by expert testimony and a stunning array of third-party testimony offered by witnesses called at trial. In addition,
you know, because you raised this point.
And yes.
I think I got to that, how limited our standard of review is on these issues.
Yes.
But one thing, so I just want to zero in on what I think mm-hmm. are more legal arguments, and that's with regard to the property division with the gifted condominium.
Yes.
I think the allegation was made that the judge specifically excluded the evidence that the appellant wanted to present, and that what evidence the judge considered was hearsay. How do you respond to that? Because I do think that's a legal argument.
First of all, with respect to the legal argument of exclusion on and any concern raised by the appellant on evidentiary arguments, I think it's important that this court keep in mind that there was never a motion for a new trial that was brought, much less one that cited concern about evidentiary rulings made by the trial court as a potential basis for overturning or for challenge on appeal. I would ask the court to note the Supreme Court decision, State Department of Labor and Industry v. Wince, 558 Northwest 2nd. I believe the case is at, excuse me, I have it in my notes. 480, 558 Northwest 2nd 80. No, I apologize. That's a separate point. Sauter v. Wassmiller, 389 Northwest 2nd 200. So I don't believe there are any evidentiary hearings properly before this court. That's the first piece. The second piece that is important is I believe counsel is misstating the record. I don't know what specific evidence she is complaining was excluded by the court. And whether that was appropriate, aside from whether this issue is properly before this court. As far as hearsay goes, here are the considerations I believe the court had in mind when it conducted its analysis. First of all, we have Minnesota Statute Section 518.58 that creates the presumption that property is marital unless a proponent of a non-marital claim is able to prevail in overcoming that presumption. So we start there. Secondly, we look at the evidence that was actually offered at trial on this issue. The first and most seminal document is the deed by which the parties took ownership. There's no hearsay objection. It was properly before the court. It was a warranty deed from Mr. Stanton's father, the appellant's father, to the parties as joint tenants. And that is easily the most basic evidence as to donative intent. Secondly, we have the matter of Mr. Stanton's gift tax return that was admitted into record, not as a hearsay. There was no hearsay objection, and I believe it was admitted into record by agreement of counsel. That gift tax return confirms the gift to the parties in equal shares of the condominium at issue. And then thirdly and importantly, we have the affidavit of James Stanton that was executed prior to his passing that confirmed his donative intent. I believe it's Trial Exhibit 226. And the important thing about that document that puts aside the issue of donative intent once and for all is that contrary to the appellant's brief, it was admitted into evidence by stipulation of the parties. So there is no evidentiary objection that can hold water with respect to that document as supplemental evidence of the elder Mr. Stanton's donative intent with respect to the property.
You're saying it was never objected to on hearsay grounds?
There were objections originally tendered, but if the court, I believe we've got a citation in our brief, it is on the May 6th transcript, page 79, I believe, we've referenced in our brief, I think in the statement of the case, confirms the stipulation that document can be introduced into evidence by agreement of counsel, both counsel. So there was
and waived any hearsay objection.
Yes.
It was a stipulation to actually admit it.
Yes. And that exchange is found in the transcript itself. We also provided to the court in advance of trial a detailed legal memorandum supporting our position as to why it should be accepted. But that became irrelevant once counsel stipulated to its admission into the trial court record. So we have the document. Excuse me, I'm just looking to see if I can find specific reference to that without taking much time. I apologize. I don't want to take up the court's time, but we did reference it in our brief. There was a stipulation as to admission of the affidavit of Mr. Stanton that confirmed his donative intent as affirmed by the deed itself by which the parties took title and as affirmed by Mr. Stanton's gift tax return. There was reference by counsel to some other documents. Those were never offered. And this is where it's important that the court consider. We have a voluminous record here, but an easy way to look at this is to take a look at original exhibit lists. Citations are made to documents in the brief that were never offered and were not made part of the trial record. So I'm kind of stuck in terms of saying anything other than what we've said in the brief, which was we object to consideration of any such documentation. So, Your Honor, I don't know if that answered your questions.
I think so, and I appreciate that. And so I want to move on to another legal argument.
Yes.
Because I think we agree that those should be considered by the court.
Of course.
And that is that with regard to the stipulation that your client paid for one half of the supervision expenses.
Yes.
And the argument, as I understand it, from the appellate.
Judge Hooten, can I interrupt you, Judge Hooten? I think your microphone is back. We could get a little better sound. Move it closer to you. There we
all
go.
Right. Is that better?
Oh, thanks so much. Okay.
All right.
Go ahead.
Sorry about that. As I look at the argument made by the appellant, is that this was a lawful agreement. But the court can't come back and change that agreement. How do you respond to that argument?
Certainly, we disagree with that assertion. First of all, we start with Minnesota Statute Section 518.131, which is the statute that governs issues relating to temporary matters as parties roll through a divorce proceeding. That statute is very clear at Subdivision 9 to state a temporary order. And it incidentally doesn't distinguish between stipulated orders or orders issued by the court as a consequence of a dispute between parties, shall not prejudice the rights of the parties or a child, which are subsequently adjudicated. Really, we look at temporary orders of the sort we're dealing with here as placeholders. Parties don't have, and in part, that is because orders that issue under 518.131 are not appealable. There is additional case law referenced in our brief that confirms that the issuance of a temporary order, again, not distinguishing between orders issued by stipulation or as a consequence of disputed matters submitted to the court for resolution, does not limit the court's ability to fashion a final order in such a way as to accommodate the facts as they've developed throughout the course of the proceeding. That is the case of Korf v. Korf, cited on page 47 of our brief. Now, it's also important for this court to keep in mind that at the time that that order issued for payment of supervision fees, the case was at the very beginning. I believe it was April of 2017, a matter of weeks after the first OFP issued. There was no question there would be supervision. It had been recommended by a guardian ad litem appointed in the OFP proceeding and by Child Protective Services. What we didn't know at the time was that this case would proceed over the arc of 2 years, and that during the bulk of that time, there would be no child support or financial support paid by the respondent, by the appellant to the respondent. What we also didn't know was that the appellant would make four separate requests for continuances after trial dates had been set, requests that were granted, I think, out of a concern on the part of the court to ensure the integrity of this record in such a highly contested proceeding, but which added months to the term that this case was pending. What we also didn't clearly understand at the time that this temporary order issued was the appellant's failure to participate in a timely way in the stipulated evaluation process we agreed would be conducted by Carol Tellett. Although we agreed in the spring, early summer of 2017 that there would be a neutral evaluation and that Carol Tellett would be the evaluator, it was not until March of 2018 that the appellant even bothered to submit his initial questionnaire form, which is always the starting point for these evaluations. So in short, we have 518.131 and Corf v. Corf, which conferred upon the trial court the authority to issue this order. And then we have the reality of the circumstances presented by this case that led her to conclude it would be unfair in this case to saddle responsibility for these expenses on my client, particularly given the nature of the expenses at issue.
Well, and as I understand it, the only thing that's being contested here is the amounts that were paid from May 2017 to December 2018. Am I correct?
Yeah, and that was when the court, I think as a consequence of requests for continuance, there was a point at which under a temporary order, the appellant was obligated to pay all expenses. The issue of, and we brought a motion asking
But I note that the reasons the court gave as this being fair and equitable is that that during that period of time there was no child support, and that there is also no contribution made by the husband relative to the marital asset of the homestead. So those were the two reasons given by the court.
Yes, he did not make, there were contributions that were made through a jointly held Wells Fargo account that was funded in part by the proceeds from the sale of the condominium. So it isn't, one could argue, and I'm sure the appellant does, that his contribution came through the use of marital, through use of assets, but nothing was paid from presumptive earnings on his part through child support or contributions to the home that went beyond, of course, the fact that there was no mortgage. We had,
Well, let me ask you this, because we're running out of time, and I need to understand this. The court also, as part of the J&D, ordered retroactive child support.
Yes.
And that retroactive child support, as I understand it, was retroactive back to April 27, 2017, the date of separation. Am I correct?
That is the first day of the first month following the separation and the issuance of the OFP and the commencement of the proceeding, yes.
Right. And as I look at this, then, I mean, so in that we're dealing with the exact same time period as this reimbursement, doesn't this kind of, I mean, it seems like it, the court is saying, I'm going to allow this reimbursement because there was no child support. But then in the same order, the judge says, oh, you have to pay retroactive child support as well.
I hear you on that, Your Honor.
Yeah. But the how do we balance that?
We balance it because the level of support we're talking about is either equal to or is equal to or less than the amount of supervision fees that were occasioned by the appellant's behavior. And the record is replete with evidence as to the need for the supervision in this case. So the question then becomes, and I think it's what was in the trial court's mind, is it at all fair to order child support to only have it eaten up completely with payment for supervision expense so that the appellant, who is the reason that the supervision expense is required, can spend time with his children. My client has always been supportive of the parenting time, no allegation to the contrary, but the question is, by whose conduct is the fee required? And who, as between the parties, is best equipped to cover it? We have the inheritance that's the subject, and as a consequence of that, widely disparate finances between the parties. And then we have an additional consideration, which is the lack of child support and the financial problems my client faced as a consequence of making due for so long.
And if I could impose on our presiding judge, can I ask another question?
Of course.
Okay, thank you. You know, one thing, and I was looking, there's been an objection to the award of retroactive child support back to April 27 of 2017. And it's my understanding that usually if there's going to be a retroactive award, it's back to the date that there's a motion or a request brought to the district court. And you can't go beyond that. And I'm looking at the dates here, and I couldn't find anything in the record that there was a request. The earliest request is April 25th of 2018. How does the court justify under our case law a retroactive award almost a year past the date that it was first requested?
Certainly. I understand the question. And I think if I'm understanding the court's question, what we're talking about is the notion of modification of a pre-existing order brought under 518A point either 33 or 39. I apologize, but it's the modification statute. Mm-hmm. I'm old enough now 39. I'm old enough now to say the new one, but it's probably been in place for longer than I care to admit. But that requirement applies to modification motions. What we are talking about is issues relating to affecting equity with respect to financial matters as they evolve during the course of a proceeding. That takes us back to 518.131 subdivision 9 and the precepts of Corf v. Corf. The court can affect equity by dealing with an allocation of resources on a temporary basis through a look back. So I think we're talking about two statutory schemes intended to address two very different issues. And we have not ever understood or intended to be a 518A 39 modification proceeding that has the requirements that you've referenced.
Any other questions from my colleagues?
No? Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I need you to unmute, counsel. Thank you.
All right. I'll start with counsel's attempt to be in the mind of the court to try to explain what statutes the court relied on to do this, to do that, to modify, to go retroactively to child support. None of what counsel is saying is stated on the judgment and decree. Counsel for the first time is trying to say why the court did so and so. That's the job of the court. There has been no motion to modify the child support during the proceeding.
I think that was the point, is that we're not in a modification.
Yes.
Right.
So she was making a legal argument. How do you respond to her legal argument that this was not a modification? This was basically a proceeding that's brought under 518A.131 subdivision 9 in Corp v. Corp. How do you respond to that?
That proceeding, which the court, if we assume the court followed that statute, the court already issued as part of the judgment and decree that my client going forward will be 100% responsible for paying the supervision fee. That's how you change temporary orders. The statute does not allow the court to go retroactively. You can reverse your order by issuing a new order, but you don't start from the beginning. Whatever counsel referred to is not part of the statute. With regard to the evidence counsel referred to, the evidence was excluded because...
Well, can I ask you this? I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to get to the legal arguments here, because that's your best chance for reversal, is making a legal argument. But counsel has basically argued that when you have temporary orders, that the law allows the court to adjust by even a retroactive order, any awards that are given in that temporary order. Is that an incorrect statement of the law?
No. The temporary orders should not be relied on to prejudice the child or the father. Here, who's prejudiced by this? Nobody. There was an agreement to pay equally for supervision fees. My client, who was having no income, agreed to this. She offered it. She agreed to it. There was no prejudice. She insisted on having the child to be seen in supervised setting, even though the guardian ad litem recommended otherwise. This is what she wanted. This is what she agreed to do. I don't see any prejudice. She was living mortgage free. She was having all the household expenses paid. She had her attorney's fees paid by my client dual signature account that he was not allowed to touch. There is no prejudice here to the respondent to say I was prejudiced because I agreed to do this. And that argument was never made in court. There is no argument about hardship for paying this. There is no argument to this, what counsel just manufactured. With regard to the evidence excluded or included, I sent a letter of objection to the court. The court did not like my letter. The court asked me to write another letter after 8 hours of trial the first day. I did send the letter. The court again rejected my objection and ruled that the court would accept all the evidence offered by counsel, which is hearsay. All of them, hearsay. The court, the first day, the court said it would rely on evidence presented at trial and evidence that is part of the record already. Well, the affidavit explaining why my client's father did the gift tax isn't a part of the file. The trust and the amended trust explaining why my client received less inheritance because of the condo is part of the trial record. I mean, the court record. Everything is designed by court to take my client's money that he didn't have yet. And this is the case. Also part of, I gave one example about the $20,000, but there are many examples for attorneys allowed. For example, counsel asked for attorney's fees for the order for protection. The statute for order for protection does not allow attorney's fees.
Counsel, your time has expired. If you want to wrap up your rebuttal, please.
I ask the court to reverse this ruling. Because many of the ruling are either not supported by law, the court misapplied the law, or the evidence does not support the court findings and conclusion.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.